session will be recorded. The recorder will not be turned off during the session if you do not wish to be recorded. Thank you. In the spirit of the fifth tradition, to carry the message, the session will be recorded. The recorder will not be turned off during the session. If you do not wish to be recorded, you may participate by listening or attending another session. We ask those who choose to share to step up to the microphone so that those who listen to the recording can follow the discussion. Will you please join me in the with the serenity prayer? God, grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference. Not mine, be done. The essay purpose. Sexaholics Anonymous is a fellowship of men and women who share their experience, strength, and hope with each other that they may solve their common problems and help others to recover. The only requirement for membership is a desire to stop lusting and become sexually sober. There are no dues or fees for SA membership. We are self-supporting through our own contributions. SA is not allied with any sect, denomination, politics, organization, or institution, does not wish to engage in any controversy, neither endorses nor opposes any causes. Our primary purpose is to stay sexually sober and to help others to achieve sexual sobriety. Okay, so the topic here is freedom of choice. I think the purpose, I'm going to talk for a few minutes, then I'm going to have Jeff talk for a few minutes as a discussion meeting, and then we'll have others step up and get involved. I think the... You know, my purpose, and as I think about starting this, is to talk about hope and talk about how we get to recovery through working the steps. I'm going to talk a little bit because before I work the steps, I don't have any freedom of choice. My experience is that I had an obsession, I was compulsive, and I had no way of stopping. And after I worked the steps, I had some freedom, and I could live a different life because I chose to let God do for me what I couldn't do for myself. And any choice that I had came out of my main choice, which was turning my life over and my will over to the care of God as I understand Him. So I'm going to talk for myself what it was like before, what it was like after I worked the steps, and an example of how the steps gave me some freedom and some recovery and some choice. And then we'll hear from others. A couple examples for me, what it was like before I worked the steps was, you know, one of my ways of acting out was going to strip clubs. And, you know, I live in North Carolina now. I lived in L.A. at the time. I used to have to go back along the Sunset Strip and some areas where there was lots of places to act out. So I'd drive home, I'd see signs for strip clubs, and I'd grip the wheel really tight because I didn't want to go, I didn't want to look at the signs. But once the thought entered my mind, the car went on its own, you know. I had two kids that I loved. I had a wife that I loved, and I'd end up at the strip club. And, you know, I'm going to go in. I'm just going to look at the women up there. I'm going to maybe spend $20. I could spend a lot of money. I ended up, you know, I'd spend more money than I wanted. I'd get a lap dance. I didn't want to go out and ask, you know, I'd ask the women to go out and be prostitutes with me. And I felt very ashamed of that. And I didn't want to be doing that, and I didn't want to be there. But anytime I tried something, I couldn't stop. It was in my brain. I couldn't shut it off. And I was often ashamed and afraid and shaky afterwards, when I came in the program, I'd been acting out for 25 years. I hadn't seen 30 days sober in in over 20 years. I was acting out every day or every other day. I was glad to see that there were some people who were sober. It still was difficult for me to believe that I could ever be sober, because I hadn't seen anything like that in so long. And all I knew is that over any period of time, something new would come in my mind that I would think, well, I'll never do that, and I would do it, and I couldn't go back. I was in a line of work where I worked on the computer all the time. I needed to be able to sit down and work on the computer. But, you know, I'd get a thought in my mind, oh, I should go over and look at this. And I could be on the computer for hours looking on the internet. I could be doing something legitimate and see an ad on the computer, a picture, and I'd be off. And I'd like, no, I don't want to do that. And I was scared to sit down. How am I going to sit down and get any work done? How can I sit down in front of this machine? Because it's going to eat me. You know, there were times that's just what I felt. That was what it was like before I worked the steps. After working the steps and continuing to work the steps, it doesn't make the circumstances of life go away. You know, there's you know, the economy's not great. There's financial stuff for my family and I. I find there's still some career things I'm working through. You know, we've got two wonderful daughters. The oldest, 5 and 7. The oldest is doing great in school. The youngest, you know, she had some speech issues when she was younger. She got some help with that. That was great. But they told us, oh, when she gets to school, she could have some reading issues. And now she does. And we're, you know, working through that. You know, my wife, she's turned 40 recently. She's, you know, she would say, and I would agree, that she's kind of having a bit of a midlife crisis. And there's a lot more irritability and frustration and emotions going on, because there's some transitions happening in her life. Just normal stuff. But what's different is, for me, is that I react differently. You know, I can. There was a day that I couldn't be on the internet without an internet blocker. And even with the blocker, that didn't keep me sober. I was finding ways around it, and I can always go act out some other way. But I can be on the internet today, and, you know, I go to Yahoo. Every time I close Yahoo now, there's some ad that's triggering for me after I close Yahoo. I see it, and I'm still a sexaholic. You know, the thought goes through my mind, wow, if I could just have that, everything would be perfect. You know? And then I just surrender it, and I close Yahoo, and I go on and do what I was set there to do. And I don't have any internet blocker, and I'm not struggling with it, because I'm focused on working my program and being of service to somebody else, and I have and there's some serenity in my life. I go down, you know, I can see ads for strip clubs. I don't have a compulsion to go in. I mean, if I don't take care of myself, I don't overwork. I get good sleep. I call other people. I work my program. I meditate and pray. And if I'm doing those things, then I can see a temptation and I can surrender it. I've got 3 years sobriety right now. So that's different, because I had no choice around that. But what's more important to me has been the internal changes. You know, seeing the changes in my marriage, having a good relationship and laughing with my wife, and feeling that, rather than feeling like we're fighting all the time and we're going to get divorced, that we really love each other and we enjoy each other and we enjoy our kids, and I feel good about my marriage. It's feeling internally that I'm not full of anxiety and fear and anger, that I have people that I really care about and that care about me, that I can be of service in the program, that I have a real relationship with my higher power, with God that's active rather than I had a lot of belief before, but I had a lot of intellectual stuff. You know, I didn't know how to pray. The program taught me how to do that. And that's been pretty wonderful. The difference, one of the ways I want to talk about the difference for me, which I think is what's important, is for me, how the program gave me some freedom of choice was, for example, with steps 4 through 7. You know, I found my wife and I arguing a lot. I found myself, my wife would do something and then she would get in, say something that was to humiliate me and to be, you know, in her anger, and then I would, and kind of bait me, and I would take the bait, and then I would say something and attack her, and I just couldn't let go of it, you know. I would resent her, I would think about all her problems, and I'd come back and restart the argument, and I'd hold on to that for days or weeks, or and it would just go on, and there was just constant back and forth, and I was pushy and I was demanding, and I needed to control her and let her make her into the way I wanted her to be. Once I got the concept of the 4-step, you know, and then I had to start on a daily basis doing 10-step work, and I'm like, ah, shit, why do I need to look at this? You know, it's like, it's obvious that it's that bitch's fault. You know, this is what's going through my mind. You know, I mean, anybody can see, look at what she did. But then, you know, when I actually sat down and did a 4-step, what happened was I could see, when I saw my part, the obsession could leave. And I could begin to see, oh, I can do something different. I have a choice here. I don't have to treat my wife this way. I don't have to wait for her to be in the program, for her to go to therapy, for her to something to happen with her. I can do something about my part, and things can change. And that's what happened. I just, you know, I saw my part. I dealt with my part, and I didn't carry around all of that resentment and anxiety and obsession, and something that could take a week to deal with, I could deal with and let go of in half an hour. And that was what the step gave me. It gave me a chance to calm down, to get rid of all the, you know, to have the arguing, you know, drastically diminish, and then for us to be able to enjoy each other and for something to grow in terms of intimacy that wasn't possible before. There's other things I could talk about with first step and meditation, but I'm going to leave it at that. And I want to give Jeff a chance and then hear from other people what's helpful for you in finding real freedom, the ability to choose instead of living a compulsive, obsessive life, and how you found recovery.
Thanks, Richard. Jeff, recovering sexaholic.
Hi, Jeff.
First time I've talked in a microphone this weekend, so we'll see how it goes. You know, I'm thinking about, I was thinking as Richard was talking about how many different times I tried to stop acting out. My acting out was pretty much fantasy masturbation, pornography, and to the point many times of hurting myself. And I would have relationships that were based on sex, but primarily my acting out was on my own. And looking back on it, some of the things I remember doing were being a camp counselor and being in the top of a rickety bunk with a boy underneath me and other boys in the room. And I wasn't fantasizing about them, but as we were going to sleep, I couldn't not masturbate, you know, lying in bed above this boy. Or in college, you know, masturbating with the blinds open, and in my room faced the center of the dorm. It was a kind of a rectangle, and being aware at some point that someone was watching me from the lobby, and you know, doing things like that, where I couldn't not do it, even though there was a chance of being caught, there were other instances like that, but that's enough for now, I think. But I was aware early on, even as a teenager, that that this was something that I didn't feel good about and felt that there was something wrong. But there was no way I could stop. No way I could not do it. I tried many, many times, and always felt a lot of guilt and shame around it. And you know, I'm not telling anybody that there's something wrong with masturbation, or you know, that whether or not other people in who are not in this program can do that healthily. I just know for me that it was something that I used to escape from life. I remember at an early age being able to escape in my mind. I didn't need something outside of myself to escape. I could do it up here and go away from whatever was going on. And you know, I think masturbation was just an extension of that fantasy world for me. And so, you know, that went on for years. And then at one point I was working in a substance abuse recovery program, and I opened a book on addictions and read that there was something called sex addiction. And I immediately thought that was me. And so I sought out meetings, and this was in the early 90s. And I remember going to a bunch of meetings and several different S fellowships, and I don't remember anybody talking about getting a sponsor and working the steps. So I managed to avoid that somehow, and didn't stay around very long. And so it was another 8 years before, in 99, I was in recovery in another program. And by the way, during that time when I was in those S fellowships in the early 90s, I white-knuckled 2 months of sobriety. But it really was just, it was sheer willpower, and there was no joy or freedom in it. And at the end of that time, everything was the same. Nothing had changed at all. I managed it because I was going to meetings, maybe. I don't know why I was able to manage that 2 months, but it was irrelevant, you know. It didn't change my life at all. And I don't know why I didn't hear the message about sponsorship and steps at that time. I suppose I wasn't ready. I don't really know. But anyway, so got in the program in 99. And this time I had a sponsor in another program and was working the steps in another program and was getting relief. And so I knew about all that stuff. And I still didn't get a sponsor right at first. And I was trying to work the steps on my own in SA in Asheville in, you know, late 99. And so I was working the steps on my own and getting nowhere. I would go about 3 weeks of not acting out, you know, really on self-will, and then binge. And I'd go another 3 weeks and then binge. And I'd go another 3 weeks and binge. And it happened over and over again. I remember talking to somebody. There was also a meeting in another fellowship at that time in Asheville, and I was going to both meetings. And I remember talking to a person in this other fellowship on Christmas Eve, 99, and we talked for a long time, and at the end of it, I just said, you know, I think I'm just going to go act out, and I couldn't not do it. Fortunately, 9 years ago, in January of 2000, there was a conference here, and that was the turnaround. Another member and I went to the conference in Nashville in January of 2000. And our meeting, we had one meeting a week at that time, plus there was one meeting in this other fellowship. And the meetings tended to be about six people, five of whom had acted out the previous week. And there was no solution, you know, people weren't getting, there was one guy who had a long distance sponsor and he was sober. You know, everybody else was pretty much, it seemed to me there was not a lot of solution in the meetings at that time. So again, two of us went to Nashville, and we weren't even close friends at that time. We just sort of knew each other. But I can remember Sunday morning after that conference, sitting around and talking to Jim, you know, we knew at that point there was a solution. I mean, it was profound. And during that conference, I'd just been, you know, I was afraid and all the rest of it and struggling and suffering. But I was trying to get up my courage between meetings to speak to people. And there was one guy that I almost let pass by, but I just barely got up my courage to speak to him. And I said, you know, I'm trying to work step one and I'm not getting anywhere with it. And he said, well, why don't you come up to my room? We'll work on it for a little while. And so he skipped a meeting or two to work with me up in his room. And I've told this story many times in Asheville, but within 20 minutes, I knew I was getting it. All that work I had done on my own was getting me nowhere. And this guy was asking me the most simple questions, but I knew it was working. And, you know, I imagine part of that, too, was that I'd been going to meeting after meeting after meeting over the weekend. It was slowly sinking in. But it was also that being in contact with somebody else that could do for me what I could not do for myself. And so I asked him to be my sponsor, and I had a long-distance sponsor for a while until things got healthier in Asheville and I could ask somebody locally to be my sponsor. But I got sober at that point. And also I've left the program twice since then, thinking that I could control and manage this. I was crazy out there. It's amazing to me how living life on my own, through Jeff's will, I've had to prove it to myself that I'm not in control. And the great thing about that is that life without Jeff in control is incredibly better. It is often happy, joyous, and free. Not all the time, but life with Jeff and trying to be in control is definitely not happy, joyous, and free. I've been. That's really all I have to share. I want to open it up for other people. And I think looking around, seeing how to figure out how to do this, I think what maybe I'll do is give up this chair and maybe Richard, we could let your chair be the place where people come to share and kind of if we can have an on deck circle and so on if people want to come up and okay. Yeah, we can also do it this way. So just asking if people would, since there's so many people in the room, to keep your comments brief enough that we give a lot of people a chance to share. And if you're coming up to share, sit in this chair, please share into the microphone. And then if other people want to come up and be ready, that's great. Thanks a lot.
Hi, I'm John H. I'm a recovering lustaholic.
Hi, John.
In 1964, I started acting out in a foreign country, and it took off like a brush fire. 27 years. In 1985, I had asked for a sabbatical to get help. And I, at the end of that sabbatical, I found someone in Portland, Oregon that knew about SA. And I got into SA there. And I, for 22 months, when I went back to the foreign country where I was working out and where the acting out mainly took place, I white-knuckled it. But it didn't work because I wasn't working the steps. I had no one else there. I was trying to set up meetings and everything. It just didn't work. But it took me six years before I actually realized that I was in a slippery place. I was just surrounded by all kinds of things that triggered me. And I just had no control, as we've heard these gentlemen share it all well. So I ran it on myself, and I said, I'm going home and get some help. So I got into the Sabbath program up in Massachusetts, was there for 3 months, and began to work the steps. But even then, When I started to work the steps, as was shared here, then I began to realize that there was an opening. And the time I left in August 6th of 91, when I left the foreign country, relationships with everyone stopped. However, there was still, it took me another 6 years before I stopped with self-excitement with myself. So I had that. But the first one is helpful, that I, when I got out of the slippery place and made that choice to go home and get help, I got it. But it still took more years in order to be able to stop in our sense of sobriety, acting out with myself. Another 6 years. And so that, then my sobriety date there is June 12th, 97. But just saying that this thing is so devastating, you know. But when I got a sponsor and I started to work the steps, then I began to have a choice. And I remember one time I was where I work at a retirement home for a lot of elderly gentlemen, and there was one of the aides there, and she stopped me in the stairwell and she said, "I'd like to seduce you." And I says, "Honey, it wouldn't do you any good, then it wouldn't do me any good." I says, "Forget it." Fortunately, you know, if that had happened earlier, we would have been off and running. So it just shows that the program works where you have different choices. But, you know, why did it take so damn long? I don't know, just, you know, thick Mick or whatever. But I just didn't get it. I was trying to do it all by myself, as we shared, someone else has shared. But it's only when I was able to allow other people to come in and be able to be directed that I began to get choices. And when I accepted my weakness, and one of the biggest things I have is that self-hate, because when I would go into the fourth step or the eighth step and bring up this, I'd say, "Oh God, you're worthless, you know, you dirty son of a gun." You know, it was just made me powerless. So it's only with working the steps and having a good sponsor that began to say, you know, I'm not my behavior. It's what's, because I had my thinking, I am my behavior. And people began to say, "You're much more than your behavior." And when that came through, then I was able to make good choices. And I'm just so glad that the program found me and has given me that opportunity. Thanks.
My name is Anthony. I'm a sexaholic.
Anthony.
Thanks for the share. It's good listening. I suppose for me, very briefly, I've just wrote down a few things that I want to read out that are my experience, strength, and hope today, this morning. For me, just like the last speaker, I had to start taking direction and stop following myself well. And make phone calls two or three times a day, go to as many meetings as possible as I could per week, and most importantly was to get honest and to share the things I was afraid of sharing. So I just jotted down a few things I'm going to read out briefly. Number one, that it was Mike that got up in the last meeting from Chicago that shared how he was feeling, that inspired me to get up and say, "Yes, Anthony, talk about what's going on for you today." I'm afraid to share this stuff in case I'm rejected. I'm afraid to share how I'm feeling in case I don't sound good or appear good as I would want to. And it's my ego that wants it that way, to put on a good appearance all the time as opposed to leading with my weaknesses. And my weaknesses today that are my fears of slipping after I leave the convention, you know, and acting out. But more importantly, that they're fueled really by my defects today, which are superiority and pride and arrogance. And I can say those words, but what do I mean by those words? My addict, I can see today as well as I write this, is my addict will tell me that I'm better than other people in this room. And what that does is that disconnects me. And then I run the risk of going back out there. And I lack humility. And my addict will tell me that I'm not as bad as other people I've heard sharing over the weekend. And that I can try to justify that in my head and become self-righteous and think that I only practice certain behaviours and I didn't practice others. And one of the things that I wrote down further on, and my addiction could have resulted in several pregnancies, and that could have led to abortions, and that could have led to murders. And I dismiss those things, and I don't think about those things consciously, and I could have spread disease, and others may have committed suicide as a result of my behaviours. I could have committed suicide myself, which I considered. And yet, as I say those words and I've written them down, I don't feel this stuff deeply enough yet, and I don't feel it sufficiently to be somewhat humble and focus on my weaknesses as opposed to finding fault in others, which I'm wonderful at doing because I don't want to look at myself. And the other things that I wrote very briefly was just that it is bordering on the fatal for me to delay on the steps. I've just started on step 9, and for some reason when I start on a step I feel wonderful, and then if I delay for a few weeks the old stuff starts to come back up again, and I think it's my higher power's way of saying to me, Anthony, you need to get working on the steps and to keep moving through this. And I think it says somewhere in the big book that delay may be fatal, and I don't want to go down that road again. And my addict will tell me that the 9th step will be difficult, and my pride tells me I don't really need to admit that I was wrong. And my sponsor said to me recently, it's very easy for me to say I was sorry. You know, I'm sorry for doing this, and I'm sorry for doing that, and I'm sorry, you know, sorry, sorry, sorry. But actually, he says, if I choose to use the words I was wrong, he says they're much more powerful, because I was wrong in many, many ways. And just last night I was irritable when I was at Mass. And I wanted to blame the church, and I wanted to blame my devout Catholic mother, and I wanted to, my devout family, and I didn't want to admit that I was wrong in any way. I wanted to blame others and their self-righteousness. And you know, when I think, sometimes I can't see it when I'm blaming others, that really is saying something about me. I didn't want to admit that I was focused on the negative yesterday evening when I was sitting in Mass, as opposed to all the positive things that the Catholic Church does, and that other people do, and that fellowships worldwide do, because I was focused on the negative as opposed to the positive. So I'll finish on this just to say that the steps give me the freedom to choose life, recovery, honesty and wholesomeness and integrity and truth, and the truth, as my mother always said to me, the truth will set you free, and I never knew what that meant. But today I'm getting some sort of just a little insight into it, and I'll finish definitely on this to say that my arrogance, so arrogant, yet the last thing that I wrote was that I could not stop acting out on my own. It was only through coming to SA and slipping and then trying something different and that I got the longest period of sobriety that I have had today at a time, and yet I still have the arrogance to say, you know what, you know, maybe I'm just a bit better than those guys. So I have a lot of work to do, but thank God I have the freedom of choice today to, and that there's a program of recovery, and I'll leave it at that. Thanks.
One thing I meant to say earlier, no disrespect to anybody that came before, but we wanted to try to hold it to 3 minutes because we have a lot of people in here, and that will give more people a chance to speak. So you can try to be conscious of that.
Hi, I'm Sam Sexaholic. Grateful to be here. Freedom to me only comes when I'm in surrender, and I've learned at this conference that when I surrender, I'm not really surrendering anything, because I never had anything. That's my addict and my disease. I'm really just surrendering the concept of having something, and that's where I run into problems, you know. Also, I don't have the freedom to choose whether to be sober today or not. That's not my decision. I'm not management. I've turned my management over. But I do, through the grace of God and contact of others, my higher power gives me, it's a gift, gives me the choice to take certain actions. You know, just like our program is a program of suggestions, you know. I'm constantly given choices, you know, and through the wisdom of this fellowship, I try to make what I think are the best choices I can in the moment. And I'm not great at this, but I'm practicing to use prayer and my constant contact with God to bring him in on that conversation as I go through the day, because I run into this hundreds of times a day. I mean, just, you know, from the time I get up in the morning to the time I go to bed, constant choices. So I'm just constantly praying, asking for guidance, and it's working in my life. I'm 4 years sober, and I'm living the promises. So I'm grateful for this topic. Thanks.
I'm David. I'm a grateful recovering sexaholic.
Hi, David.
Just two things I want to say. One is I have to keep remembering the core message of recovery for me, which is that if I'm upset, it's about me, no matter what it is. And remembering that and practicing that, which really came to me about from working the steps, that really helps me stay away from a lot of the emotional insanity that would drive me back into my addiction. The other thing that is really helpful for me in terms of freedom of choice is remembering I'm powerless. That's step one. I'm powerless over lust. But step 11, and I heard this actually from Harvey at a conference a few years ago, step 11 talks about praying only for the knowledge of his will and the power to carry it out. And the word power comes back there. And as long as I'm getting my power from God, from my higher power, then that's the direction that I do. I can have the power to make choices that are healthy. So saying I'm powerless doesn't have to mean I'm helpless, I have no choice, I'll go off into the addiction. I can turn back to the steps and ask for help from my higher power. Thanks.
Thanks, David.
Time myself. Hi, my name is Eric. I'm a sexaholic. I felt moved to get up here. It's the first time I did this conference, just because of the word of this. I just want to share with you, probably about a year and a half ago, you got to speak right into it, probably about a year and a half ago, I was really struggling. I just gotten married. It was the first time I came close to seeing a prostitute. I started really thinking about how I was going to change things. And it's just been a slow process over the last year and a half of slowly surrendering more of my life to my higher power as expressed through this fellowship. At that point, I started a meeting about an hour and a half from where I lived. I was going there. I was driving there already on Saturday nights, and so I was staying the night every Saturday night and staying there on Sunday morning, and so I started a meeting. At a certain point, I started doing service around that same time period. I started using a sponsor probably a couple of months later than that and started talking to this person. I was already doing retreats and everything in my area, and I started just doing every last one of them that I could, because it's hard for me. I was in an area at one time that had, I was able to go to a meeting a day, and I just want to say too that some of us are sicker than others, and I just happen to be one of the some. I don't have to understand why. It's just a fact. For me, if I don't have daily contact like that, I struggle. Well, the last thing, and I've still been struggling, and the last thing I want to say is the last, 2 months, I found these things. There's a phone meetings, these daily contact things, and some people may say, well, you know, this and that and the other, but for me, they're saving my life. I mean, I feel like I have a fellowship again. Every night at 9 o'clock Pacific Standard Time, there's a group of us that are on this line together. And I feel like I'm running with a pack again. I need that. It's like white picket fence sobriety doesn't work for me. Once a week, twice a week isn't enough for me. I don't know why that is. But I'm just finding a power through that. I'm finding a power through sacrificing the time and just sitting there with other people on this phone call and getting honest, that's made a huge difference for me. It's made a difference. It's made a huge difference. I can feel it. So there's a higher power. There's a power within the group that I can't seem to have on my own, and it guides me in working the steps as well. So anyway, I just wanted to share that. Thank you.
Thank you.
Morning, guys. I'm Steve, sexaholic from Memphis. Qualify briefly, my forms acting out were extramarital affairs, masturbation, internet pornography, internet chat rooms, phone sex, any way I could do it that I didn't have to pay for it and that nobody knew about it, pretty much. Been sober 18 months. And I think there's a couple of things that I wanted to mention. One is that there are choices that I don't have in recovery. Like, I can't choose not to go to meetings. Those are choices that, when I first got in the program, I don't know if anybody else shares that, I'm hoping to see a few nods at least, but I was waiting for the chance to know I didn't have to go to meetings anymore. Right? Like, I wanted to get to a place where I could say, hey, this is good. I can go. I don't have to go to 6 or 7 or 12 or 15 meetings a week. And I don't know, you know, I haven't gotten to that place. I can't choose not to work my program today, the same way that I can't choose not to take a shower today if I want anybody to be in the car with me or if I want my wife to get in the bed with me at night. My temptation, I've thought about it this weekend, and luckily I've got some good advice kind of floating around in my head. It didn't come from me. But I thought, man, I've been to like 20 meetings this weekend. I can take a month off. You know? I'll just take a month off. And I was sitting in a meeting, I think it was a few weeks ago, and I don't know why it stuck in my head, but this guy was like, hey, try taking 20 showers in a weekend and then take a month off. You know? So, you know, it's that kind of stuff. I don't get the choice. When I wake up in the morning, I don't get the choice of whether or not I'm going to sleep in. If I'm not maintaining my spiritual program on a daily basis, I mean, I'm resting on my laurels. And the big book says, if I'm resting on my laurels, it is a short trip to the bottom. And for me, it's back to the bottom. I don't get the choice about whether or not I believe this is a deadly disease. If I start thinking this disease won't kill me, I'm going back. I have to remember the day when I hit bottom and I was sitting on my kitchen floor with my wife crying her eyes out, my kids screaming in the next room. I have to remember the thought in my head of the $1 million insurance policy in the desk drawer and the knowledge that, hey, I know there's a clause in there that says, I've had that policy longer than 2 years, it'll pay. It's a short drive off that bridge. And that's a big deal for me. I have to remember that. I have to remember the look on my 9-year-old daughter's face when my wife was screaming at me and she was standing there getting to hear every bit of it. Not for shame. There's no shame in that. I'm completely powerless over my addiction. That releases the shame. But I have to remember it because I don't want to go back. And so I've got to maintain my program. I've got sponsees and I say, well, how many meetings a week are you willing to commit to? And they'll say, you know, I could probably do 3. And I'm like, well, I'm still doing 7. And I'm 18 months sober. For me, it's a question of, is it life or death? If I had cancer and they told me I had to go to treatment every day to live for an hour a day, I'd be like, is that all? And not only that, it's pretty painless until you start working the steps with somebody like Harvey or, you know, or me now. So, I mean, it's so much better. Now, I do have some choices, and I'm going to end with this. One of the choices that I have, my wife, when we first got into recovery, of course, my wife retaliated, obviously. I love that. I stepped on her toes a little. And so, you know, she retaliated a bit. And so one of the things that I got, I twisted her arm around her back, I said, you got to call me when you're changing plans. You know, if you say you're going to go to Walmart and you're going to Target next door, just call me and let me know you're going to be at Target instead. Yeah, because I don't need to control anything. And so one day she didn't. And I went crazy, of course. This has been, well, not as long ago as I wish it had been. And so I called my sponsor. I'm like, can you believe she's doing this? Why wouldn't, I mean, she doesn't tell the truth. She's a liar. I can't be married to a liar. And so then my sponsor says, he tells me a story about his own wife that I'm not going to share. But then he says to me, so you have to choose whether or not you're going to trust her. And I said, "You're not hearing me." I said, "She can't be trusted because she's not trustworthy." And he said, "Nobody's trustworthy. But do you want to live in a marriage? You have to choose. You can choose to trust her and assume that God's going to give you what you need. That if she's doing something she's not supposed to be doing, or if she's having an affair, if she's doing something crazy, or if she's out to hurt you, that eventually God will show that to you. Or you have to choose to leave." Because and he said, "I wouldn't want to live in a marriage where I couldn't trust my wife." Choices that I didn't think I had, I have. Choices that I thought I had, I don't. Glad to be here.
Hi, my name is Eliezer. I'm a sexaholic. For me, the question of freedom of choice is a question that I don't have the answer. I don't have which choice. I don't know. I came in the program in July 2003, and I was sober for 2 years. And in September 2005, I had a relapse, and I came to Nashville in January 2006, 3 years ago. And my wife was so impressed of Harvey, so she went over to him. She asked him, "Do you mind to be my husband's sponsor?" I wanted to kill her at that point. And he answered her, "He has to ask, it's his choice." And I was so afraid of her and so embarrassed. So I said, "Okay, do you want to be my sponsor?" But I didn't have a choice to say that. It was like God pushing me to the wall. But I am so sick that I need somebody like him to be my sponsor. And I remember we sat, Saturday night. 3 years ago we sat in the lobby, and he told me 3 conditions to be my sponsor. One of the conditions was the concept that I didn't know. I was already 2 years in SA of surrender. No matter if I want to listen or not, if I ask something, I have to follow instruction. It was the message. And during the 3 years, I had tough times with him. And I don't know where I have choices, where I don't have choices, but what I do know, that when he's telling me to do something, at that moment I have the choice to, you know what, close my mind and trust and do. And then I never regretted it. And every time when I started arguing, I saw the consequence. And I was sober since then, and sober. You will hear about it. I have only 1 minute. And 2 years ago, I started using internet in my job. I didn't have a private internet before that. But in my mind, I was sober because I didn't masturbate, I didn't go with prostitutes anymore. And after a few times sneaking on pornography for only 15 minutes and sharing it with Harvey, being honest, and he told me, "You need more than me. You need to go to rehab." And I didn't want to go. And it took me like 2 years to accept it. And in November, I went for 5 days in Hattiesburg. And I was afraid to relapse, being in a hotel alone. And when I told him I'm afraid, he gave me a suggestion. He told me, "When you come in the hotel, ask the lobby to cut off the TV for you." And I answered him, "You know, Harvey, I want to try. I'm already sober almost 3 years. I want to try." He didn't answer me. He told me, "Okay." And from the minute I went up from the airplane, in the airport in New Orleans, I started cruising the streets. I went to a bar, and I had like a week, really a crazy week, with major relapse. I ended up soliciting the cleaning lady in the hotel to have sex with her. I could be arrested, could be killed, got diseases, and I was so blind and so in denial. It was terrible. And thank God I stayed in the rehab for 6 weeks, so now I have 60 days of writing. I feel good. But I was sharing with them yesterday, and I told them, you know what I did there? I even solicited a cleaning. I never did that before. He told me, it doesn't matter what you did. I know when I told you to close the TV, and you answered me, you want to try, I knew already you were done. And that's for me, the freedom of choice. Freedom of choice is to accept that my mind is lying all the time for me. And if I got a suggestion for somebody that cares for my sobriety, I have to close my mind and follow instructions. Thank you.
Marty, recovering sexaholic.
Hey, Marty.
My sobriety date from affairs outside my committed relationship that is now my marriage is February of 1992, and sober from compulsive masturbation since March of 1998. My freedom today is, and I remember Harvey seeing this when I first got sober. I remember him saying he was free, lust free. I remember thinking, God, that little bastard's so full of shit, you know. And would get up and leave meetings he was in. And when people are sharing, I realize it's been a long time since I've been close to the flame. And I'm lust-free today. I don't have lust in my life. And I know you are going, that guy's so full of shit. You know, it took me 10 years to get there. And the process of freedom for me started, I'm borrowing this from another S program, with my inner circle, which is absolute bottom line behaviors, which is a red circle. And I had to get boundaries around those. And when I first got in the program, I never sought out prostitutes. There was a lot that I didn't. And my addict somehow knew the jig was up. And I was sober in another program for a lot of years. And my addict just went through the roof, you know. And this was before cell phones. I had a little can of coins in my truck and the glove box and a phone list of Nashville SA, and I would stop at a payphone and say, I'm going to a slippery part of town, going to be there, and I'll, you know, what do I do? My sponsor would say, well, what time are you going to be there, and what time are you going to call me when you get back? And it had to be specific times. And so what happens if I'm not home at 1:30? What if it's 1:45? It says you stop wherever you're at 1:30. And I thought, God, this program is so fucking fundamental dogma and all that, you know. And I stopped at 1:30 and made the call. And I had to make those kind of rigid boundaries to get me out of that red circle. And then the next 4 to 5 years was that yellow circle, which were slippery behaviors. Depending on where I was at in my spiritual maintenance, they could be about my true sexuality or they could be about lust, and it all depended on where I was at in my connection with God. And I'm here to tell you that sex isn't the enemy, and lust ain't my problem today. And it took six, seven years in this program to get that separated out, know when I had a sexual feeling that it was about my loins and about a God-given instinct and not about lust. And then there's this outer circle that I'm working on now, and this will probably be with me until I'm in my grave. And this is the green circle, and this is coming back and honoring my own sexuality and reclaiming a lot of that was taken. And a lot of the trauma I experienced as a child that I've been working on for 21 years has now finally come full circle. And I know that I've come full circle because when I hear newcomers come in and share, and they remind me of how close I was to that flame and how driven I was to get the 90-90 and call every day, and that just that intensity at which I went about this program, thank God I had it. I wouldn't be sitting here today. I'm not sure I was capable of getting that had I not had that drive. And the other thing I want to say is I never acted out. I never lusted just the lust. That has not been my experience in 21 years of sexual addiction recovery. I've never lusted the lust. I lusted for one thing. It was for comfort, and it was to go, oh, God, just to get some relief. And, you know, I got relief today. It's in you people. It's in my home. My home is a place of ease today. It's in my children. My children are a place of ease. I have relationships outside of the program. And my SA sponsor said, boy, you're really wearing this thing like a loose sleeve jacket. And I never, at least you guys who knew me when I got in here, that's a miracle, baby, because I grabbed a hold of this thing and I wrapped myself in it. And I have a lot of relationships out there that provide me comfort and ease. And my number one is with my higher power, you know. The last thing I'll share, it's probably the most scary portion of my recovery over 21 years, is a guy with 42 years of sobriety in AA I was sitting at an Al-Anon meeting. That's my primary program today. Long before I ever took a drink or acted out sexually, I was a raving codependent, stark raving mad. And my emotional dependency and my emotional lust is my drug today. That's my top plate, what I work on. And he looked at me outside of a meeting. He said, "Tell me what's wrong with this program." And he was smoking a cigarette. I said, "You can't say that in 12-step programs." And I said, he said, "Here's your problem." He said, "You're either going to step outside the umbrella of this program and develop a relationship with a power greater than yourself, on a one-on-one personal relationship. You're going to go back into this program, you're going to grab those books that you have, and you're going to start beating them on the table, and you're going to get dogmatic and fundamentalist." He said, "Nobody's going to like you." And he said, "You're going to step outside and go do your, not do your own thing, but to go develop a relationship on a personal basis with God." And he said, "It's much more scary to go do that." He said, "Because you've been doing this for 18 or 19 years, and he said, "And it's going to be scary." And he said, "You can count on three things. You'll be judged, you will have pain," he said, "but you'll be free." And he said, "I got to go," and he got in his car and drove off. You know, he left me hanging there with that matzo ball. So that's what I work on today, is a combination of balance of my freedom that comes from practicing the disciplines of this program and the fear of having a one-on-one relationship with a power greater than me. So that's my experience. Thanks.
Thanks, Marty.
Hi, my name is Akeem and I'm a sexaholic. Briefly, my means of acting out is sexually compulsive behavior, compulsive masturbation, voyeurism, internet pornography, and many others. I would like to share my experience, strength, and hope, besides the fact that I'm very confused how can we have a discussion on freedom of choice when in my book it says that we lost the freedom of choice. But that's too Talmudic. Okay, we'll leave it out there. I was promoting everybody from the groups that I go to that they should go to the convention, and I was one of the only people who did actually go. And I ended up being sick. I mean, I had a flu. And I didn't hit much meetings. And what I chose to do yesterday by the Al-Anon speaker in the morning, I, even though I get triggered right now, I'm at the point that any woman, unfortunately, God bless them, is a trigger for me. I mean, it doesn't matter. I'm sober since March 7th of last year, 6 p.m., but I'm sober today, and, you know, it's my choice. So I was searching for him, and he asked me, "Do you want to change?" I said, "Yeah." "So you better go take a nap. And you better stay in bed and don't infect anybody. And I'm feeling much better right now. And what I chose, I couldn't fall asleep because I took 3 or 4 naps during the day. So, and it was about 8 o'clock. And I figured 8 o'clock, and I used to go at phone meetings. So I called the phone meetings and I got much encouragement from them. And I said to them, "Listen, guys, you know where I am? I'm at Nashville. I'm at the convention. There's 600 people who are involved in sexaholics. And I'm this poor sexaholic who needs to hit this phone meeting. And I'm grateful, and I need to commit to you that I'm going to ask people who pay for my phone that they should take off the internet of it. And I'll delete my photo album on the internet. Thank you."
Thank you.
Thanks for everyone who shared. Just closing thought, you know, I think part of the program for me is realizing, okay, you know, I can go to meetings, I can call people, but if I don't get in there with my sponsor and really work my way through the steps, I don't get any of the promises. I did that, you know, some people have talked about, you know, I know what it was to slip, and then, you know, that humility is to ask for the help, is to say, you know, I realize today I'm working the program, but there was a time I had to say, but I'm not really working the program. And I had to admit that to myself. And then I can take a deeper step into the first step and ask for help and find some of those promises. Thanks for everyone who came up. Oh, sorry.